And we welcome you to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD 91.1 FM. Today on the Morning Show, we're going to be talking with a faculty colleague of mine from Carthage College and three students who earlier this summer were part of an archaeological dig in Israel. And we'll be talking about that experience and also the experience which they have now of turning on the television and seeing such bewildering scenes from Israel, a place they have just visited. I mean, and some of the actual places where they traveled through or visited now the site of such intense fighting. We'll talk about all that and more today on the Morning Show. We hope that you can stay with us. So some interesting things coming up on the Morning Show this week. We remind you that the program is archived on WGTD's website. Go to www.wgtd.org. You can listen to anything from the archive and even download it to your iPod. Again, we are happy to have with us today on the Morning Show four guests. One of them, a faculty colleague of mine from Carthage, Dan Showalter, professor of religion at Carthage, who has been on the Morning Show on several different occasions and often is the source of really interesting guests as well. He helps facilitate a number of interesting visits to the campus of Carthage and brings a few of them here to WGTD. And he has three students with him, two students from Carthage and another sort of student from Carthage who is actually a student from St. Olaf. We'll explain that in a moment. What all four of these people have in mind have in common is that they have come back fairly recently from an archaeological dig to Israel. And this is a joint venture, actually, between Carthage College and McAllister College. So, again, we have Professor Dan Showalter with us. We have his son with us, Jeremy Showalter, who is currently a student at St. Olaf College in Northfield, Minnesota, and working at Carthage this summer. And then two Carthage students, Zach Myers and Amanda Kidwell, who are actually both from the Kenosha area originally, and both about to be seniors at Carthage. And these are three of the students who were along on this trip to Israel, and we have a lot to talk about. So to all four of you, a welcome to the Morning Show.
Good morning.
Thanks. Good morning.
Good you can be here. It sounds like we're hearing everybody loud and clear. Professor Showalter, let's begin with you and maybe get a little history about this, I think, nearly annual trip to Israel, which has been taking place over the last few years. Just how long has this been happening, and how did this partnership with McAllister College come about?
Well, in 1998, there was actually a wildfire in the region where we dig in northern Israel, and it exposed a lot of architectural elements that led the Israel Antiquities Authority to think that there was a building there that deserved excavation. And they contacted Andy Overman, who is a professor of classics, chair of the classics department at McAllister, and invited him to come over and tour the site. And on the basis of that tour, McAllister decided to start excavating at the site, which is known as Amrit. Mm-hmm. And it was actually in 1999 that I first went along with the McAllister excavation and began working there, and have gone pretty much every year since then. We've actually not been able to take students every year because of the political situation, but pretty much every other year we've had a pretty good crew of students, around 40 or so people working and digging the site. And so this was actually our eighth season of excavation, which was very exciting and very productive this year.
Wow. Help us understand sort of the politics behind the scenes which make this happen, which give a bunch of American students access to a site like this. And when you're not there, what's happening with this site? I mean, are other people, other students, professionals in the field excavating it as well?
No, it should be a site that we have a permit to excavate, and so no one else should be digging there. Unfortunately, it's in a very remote area, which means that if somebody wants to hike in and putz around, they're able to do so, and there's very little to prevent them. But that hasn't been a big problem in the past. There hasn't been a lot of sort of illegal excavation going on the site.
So you have sole authority to be digging here.
Right. Authority is a little bit tricky, because authority related to anything having to do with excavation lies with the Israel Antiquities Authority, and that's the governing body that is in charge of all archaeological work. They give us a permit. Of course, we dig at their pleasure, in effect. If they decide we're not doing the right thing, they can tell us that we're done as well. Mm-hmm. And they also can tell us certain things about how we dig and when we dig and keep certain standards that they want to try to maintain as they're working. But any foreign school can come in and apply for a permit to dig in a particular area. And usually the way that works is you discover something new or you want to do a new dig in a place that was excavated previously, expand an excavation, that kind of thing. So you would apply with the Israel Antiquities Authority, get a permit, and then set up your excavation and go over and do the work.
How big an area are we talking about?
We probably are. The actual temple that we're excavating is about 30 meters long and about 20 meters wide, roughly. But we're starting now to probe out beyond the actual temple building and see some of the things that are going on in front of the temple, where the altar was, and in the gate complex that entered into the temple. And then we actually, this season, were able to send a group out to work in what we call the colony. Across the valley, there's a site where we think there was a sort of a major monumental entryway into the whole region and or the whole district of the temple. And so we started excavating that entryway and the road that runs between it and began to get a little bigger picture about what was going on. So we're starting to get into the neighborhood a little bit more.
Hmm. What exactly does the permit allow you to do in terms of what you are excavating? I mean, do you have access to this whole settlement called Amrit, or right now are you just permitted this specific area that you're excavating?
We specify in the permit, which we have to renew each year, the areas that we intend to work on. So we said this year that we wanted to go across the valley and work in this other area. As we are able to expand, we will have to get permission. And it is conceivable, of course, that someone else could come in and say, well, we want to dig to the east or we want to dig to the north. There are several sites in Israel that have been co-dug by different institutions. And sometimes that leads to some controversy and competition. But it can also be done in a way that's not so complicated.
Hmm. So this has happened before, these different excavations. What leads you to make a given decision about, I think this year we're going to go after this?
The directors spend time after each season looking over the finds, looking over and analyzing the areas that we have excavated and asking the question, well, what are the most important questions that we want to answer? It's almost like there are unlimited numbers of questions.
And yeah.
So we try to narrow it down, figure out what is most important for our priorities and our interests, and then dig accordingly. To this point, that's focused mostly on the main temple building, which is actually a series of buildings, at least four structures dating, we think, from the middle of the 1st century BCE to probably the 5th century CE, and so a long span of time, and a series of buildings that were built one on top of another. And so we look at that. We look at the outlying areas, and then we also look at our resources. How many people are we going to have? How much time are we going to have? What can we hope to accomplish in this given period? And then we try to do the most time-effective and cost-effective work that we can.
Hmm. Before we bring our three students in, I'm curious to know how they function on these trips and especially how much good they do. I mean, I think sometimes you can bring students along on a trip and it's almost a little more of a token sort of gesture to have them sort of be a part of it, but they're not actually really in there accomplishing a whole lot as much as observing and hopefully learning a lot. But the way this trip has been described, this doesn't seem like it's that so much. I mean,
No, definitely not.
Your students are really doing the work of archaeology.
The students will attest that this is an incredibly difficult and hard task to accomplish as they're there. They're working the whole time. They get up very early in the morning. We start try to get out to the site by 5:15, start working by 5:30 because the sun comes up shortly thereafter and it starts getting hotter and hotter, so you want to work early. We work them very hard. They do all kinds of work while we're in the field. Then we go back in. We have lunch, some time off in the afternoon, and then pottery washing, pottery readings, different work with the artifacts, all kinds of ways in which we keep them busy, let's say. And it's very difficult physical work, but it also requires, I think, some intellectual work in terms of analyzing finds, following instructions, talking about and reporting on what they're finding. It's a very interesting kind of a process, and one of the fun things is to see students who are there for a year kind of working and then moving into more of an assistant square supervisor role, helping other students learn the process, eventually becoming square supervisors. I mean, there, you can see that sort of compounding interest and investment in terms of their the time that they spend there and the things that they're learning. So I do a lot of study travel with students, and for the most part, it's been, as you say, kind of an observer role. We look at things, we talk about things, we go to museums, that kind of stuff. This is completely the opposite. They're the integral part of what we're doing, and we couldn't do it without them.
Very good. I know, Zach Myers, you are actually a classical archaeology major, so your involvement in this trip makes a lot of sense. Have you gone on this before, or was this your first time?
No, I tried going last year, but last year was like a study season for the professors, so they just reviewed like past work and archive stuff.
So but, it wasn't the same kind of trip at all then, or no trip at all?
No trip at all.
We went with the directors and actually prepared some material for publication.
Oh, I see. So you didn't have students tagging along.
Right, we didn't have students
along. Right. So, Zach, this is a long time coming for you. You were appreciative of the opportunity. And Amanda, who is a good friend of yours, you're not actually an archaeology major at all.
No, I'm actually a psychology major at Carthage.
You're what? Say that again.
Psychology major at Carthage.
For some reason, your mic's not on.
Talking to sex.
Yeah.
I'm actually a psychology major at Carthage.
Okay. So did you go into this with any idea, really, of what this was going to be about?
We had a few meetings with Professor Showalter and the other students to review literature that was relevant to our area, both the political situation and the archaeological dig and what we were kind of expected to do. And talking with Zach about his classes in archaeology, I did a faint idea of what might happen, but I feel that we did get a good fair warning that it was going to be a lot of hard work and a lot of involvement on our part.
Right. Well, good. And Jeremy Showalter happens to be Dan Showalter's son, so although you're not an archaeology student either, you probably went in with a few stories your dad has told echoing in your ears, I'm guessing.
Yeah, my brother was actually able to go on this trip 2 years ago, so two seasons before this season, and he has said a lot of things that really kind of helped inspire me to want to go about, because he himself wasn't really into he actually was, I think, just finishing high school at the time, so he wasn't into that much archaeology or classics at that point, but he still was, he said it was an experience that, you know, changed his life for the better, and so I said, well, this is something that I know my dad's been interested in, you know, for as long as I can remember. And it's also something that, I mean, I've always been interested in history, in a sense, I think, as many people are, just through my general curriculum and that kind of thing. And so I was really excited to go and kind of experience something that was related to, well, directly related to historical, kind of building the idea of history as it happens, that kind of thing. So it definitely held a lot of interest for me.
In a lot of ways, this is an opportunity for the students to make history in a direct way. I mean, they're finding things that haven't been seen for centuries, and we're talking about how they fit in with the history of the region, with the Roman Empire. This is a Roman temple site that we're working on, so it's kind of a hands-on creation of history in the way of discovery. That's pretty exciting.
Now, if we were to drive up to this site, what would we see? What does it? And I don't mean so much like even what you're doing, but if we just drove up, do we see structures or is there nothing like that there?
What remains of the temple is basically the foundations.
Okay.
So the first thing you see when you drive up are huge dirt piles and rock piles that we've accumulated in the process of excavating and uncovering these foundations.
So there's no walls remaining, no pillars or anything like that?
There are pieces of walls and pieces of pillars everywhere. Some of those are actually standing on the foundation, not necessarily in their original position, but they've been either placed back there or they just fell there and stayed there. So you can see, for instance, a large Corinthian capital on the south podium of the temple. That's pretty obvious and pretty gives you a real idea of the scale. And then you have to imagine what that would have looked like 18 meters in the air or 15 meters in the air above your head. We do have plans, and we're in the process of planning and fundraising and getting permissions to do some reconstruction on the site in which case you will be able to see several columns restored, some architrave blocks and other superstructure elements. So you get a little bit of a better sense of the scale of the thing. And I think that's a kind of cool thing for the students as well, that someday conceivably they could go back and say, well, this is, you know, I was a part of discovering and uncovering and reconstructing this.
Mm. Remind us, I know you said it quickly at the top of the interview, how this settlement was even discovered in the first place. Did you say something about a fire?
There was a ground fire, actually, a brush fire, that burned off all of the overgrowth and revealed column drums, column capitals, all kinds of blocks that made it clear there had been a significant building there. The area was actually partially excavated, or a probe was done in the early 70s by some Israeli archaeologists. And actually, that was kind of interesting because they had been there. Actually, it was the late 70s. They had been there in 67 and 73 as part of the Israeli army, the Israeli Defense Force. And in the process of just sort of guarding the border with Syria, they had found these blocks and realized that there was something significant there. So they came back in 78. They did a probe basically in the front of the temple near the stairs, but didn't find anything that convinced them or their bosses that they should be able to do a major excavation there. So then it just laid dormant until the late 90s when we started work.
And the rest has been history
so far, in
several different ways. For those of you just joining us on the morning show, we're talking with Dan Showalter, professor of religion at Carthage College. His son, Jeremy Showalter, and two Carthage students, Zach Myers and Amanda Kidwell, who earlier this summer, actually from mid-May to mid-June, were part of an archaeological dig at the site of Omrit in the northern part of Israel. So to the students, let's find out a little bit more about these grueling days which mean old Professor Showalter put you through. I mean, when you were getting to the site at 5:15, typically, what were you doing at that point in time? How did the day begin?
Well, there were a couple options on how to get out to the site. There was a bus that went out every day and took, I don't know, 20 to 25 people, or maybe actually a few less, and then several truckloads of people who we kind of rode in flatbeds out to the site with equipment, because generally we left a lot of equipment on site, but every day we had to bring back pottery finds and then various architectural elements that we didn't want to leave out just sitting out on the ground, essentially. So in the morning when we got there, it was pretty much, I'd say it was at 5:15, it was pretty dark still. And so you kind of just start to see the sun rising over toward Damascus, we would say, toward the east, kind of. The temple faces east, so if you kind of looked with the temple, you could see where the sun was starting to come up. And those would be the first few, I guess, 45 minutes of work or so would be in a pseudo-darkness, and then as the sun started to rise, it would get much brighter very quickly.
Mm.
And so it was an amazing experience, really, to be able to watch the sun rise every morning for that many days in a row. It's something that I haven't really had a chance to do in my life here. And so seeing that and having that be part of your daily routine is amazing. We actually wouldn't eat breakfast until about, I think, 8 o'clock most mornings, although I didn't really have a watch on site. It was really more about how it was kind of feeling at the time. And once you got into the labor, I didn't really notice the passage of time that much because it was a really intense hands-on process and a lot of picking and hoeing, that kind of thing.
Yeah. Zach, you're the archaeology major. Tell us a little bit about that technical stuff that Jeremy just touched on. I mean, when you actually are getting to work, describe it to us a little bit about that.
It really depends, like, what your square leader thinks you should be doing that particular day. Like, one day, maybe the square leader would tell us to just pull out our trowels. So we'd have to just work very meticulously, just picking through every piece of dirt, trying to look for a piece of pottery. But if we got to use, like, a shovel or something, we'd usually just sift that stuff, so we'd just pull everything out with our shovels, throw them in buckets, pull them out of there, and then throw them in these sifters and look for pottery or coins or figurine.
So sometimes it's extremely slow and meticulous work, and at other times you're really getting in there a little more aggressively.
Mm-hmm.
Professor Showalter, how does a decision like that get made? I mean, the square supervisor, what would lead them to go one way versus the other?
Well, in conjunction with the directors who are constantly looking over their shoulders, the square supervisor would decide on if something was like what we call a critical locus. In other words, it's in a particular place that's going to be very important for trying to date the building or identify the building or understand the relationship between one building and another. In our case, where we've got these compound buildings on top of one another, we would say, okay, this is a critical locus. You need to sift here. You need to be more careful. In other places, there's what we would call fill, which is rocks and dirt that have been thrown in to fill in an area, probably during the Byzantine period when they were putting on a new floor. And we've dug that before. We know what it is. We're not as concerned to be real careful about it. So it's just a matter of filling as many buckets as possible and getting them out of there as quickly as possible, which I know Zach enjoyed doing.
Good exercise, at least. Now, Amanda, for you and for Jeremy, for that matter, this was a brand new experience. Tell us a little bit about how you were trained to do this work.
And so before we left, we...
pull in there just a little bit.
Before we left for Israel, we did a day where we took practice elevations, which is something that we had to do frequently at the site to figure out where particular architectural blocks or important finds were in relevance to the rest of the temple and depth and height and location. So we took elevations before we left, and then once we arrived, our square leaders, there were four different main groups and eventually then five groups that split off into different squares, and my square leader was a great leader and teacher, and he explained everything that we needed to do very carefully and was oftentimes right there next to us working just as hard as we were, showing us the correct way how to use a hoe, which I don't think anybody really had a good idea of how to use before we went there, and really just by example was the biggest way we learned. So
it sounds like work that would contain a fair amount of tedium. I'm trying to phrase this delicately, but I mean, and probably it's not work for everybody. For that very reason, I mean, if somebody really needs firecrackers going off on a regular basis in their lives in terms of retaining their interest and focus, I mean, I should think this is something that really requires almost kind of superhuman levels of concentration. I mean, when or not. I mean, is it so exciting to find a little shard of pottery that keeps you going?
Yeah.
The first few days, it was really, really exciting to find pottery. I think, but even after a week or two, we are working hard every day. It's still very exciting because you see your progress every day. You're down either a couple, feet. In my case, our square, we dug a lot of fill out, so we're moving a lot all the time. Or in Zach's area, where they're working on a frescoed wall for part of the time, there's always something that was keeping your interest and was, because it was your work. You got to see what you were doing, and I think everyone cared about it and was very involved.
Yeah, it seemed like we had a really good season for finds, too, because we were working on exposing the second, I guess it would be the second temple beneath the initial two temples in our square. So on the third level of kind of building, we were starting to expose some major architectural elements, and then so every day you'd be lifting these massive blocks out of the square and you'd be moving all this dirt, but the fact that you were moving these things that were so... we'd have directors coming by and looking at them and saying, wow, that's incredible, or wow, we have to record this and that kind of thing. And so me never having done this before, I was just, every time someone did that, it was amazing. It was a reaffirming, very reaffirming thing, because you wanted to get to the next, you wanted to find the next thing, as quickly as possible. And
whatever
as carefully
that was.
As possible.
Yeah, right. Mm-hmm. I guess that's the thing that makes this interesting work, too, isn't it? That you can't just barrel in there as aggressively as you might want to.
Yeah, that's always been, I'm not the most patient person in the world, so that's always been the hardest part of it for me, is being patient and taking things slow. And I think that's, we had a volunteer who came along from California and was there for about a week, and Larry worked very hard and actually found some very interesting elements of Temple Zero, as we call it, but had to leave before we exposed the full frescoed wall that he'd come down on, and so he was frustrated about that. So we sent him lots of pictures trying to reinforce him.
Now help us understand what this wall looked like, this frescoed wall.
It may have been painted, but as far as from what I could tell, it wasn't. But it was just a white plaster that had been covered over the limestone. like a white plaster that was just placed over the limestone to make it white and shiny for the most part.
And they also put a margin on it to make it look like marble. This is an attempt by the ancient builders to economize. They can't import marble in any kind of cost-effective way, so they take the limestone blocks, they build their building, then they cover it with this gorgeous fresco plaster covering, and that is meant to shine like marble and look like marble.
Wow.
Yeah.
And we know all this, all these years later.
Sure. And it's remarkably well preserved. That was one of the most interesting things about this wall is we believe that it must have been covered over shortly after it was originally built because the plaster is in such gorgeous condition still, real fine detail work.
Wow. You know, it's interesting. I'm reminded of a conversation, and Dan, I don't know if I've ever told you about this, but a morning show conversation a number of years ago with a woman from Norway who is the curator of textiles for some archaeological museum in Norway. And so that's her specialty is uncovering textiles. And, of course, you're not very often, I'm sure, if ever, finding textiles from as far back as you're going. I mean, when we're talking about something as old as this, all that ever survives are things like pottery and coins and so on. That, in a sense, that's such a frustrating thing, isn't it? That nothing, in a sense, nothing soft and delicate survives from that long ago.
Right.
It just can't.
It depends on the climate, of course. If we were digging in Egypt, we'd have where there's a drier climate, we'd have a better chance of finding organic materials. In our case, it's always possible that you'd stumble on something, but it's the most we find bones in some cases. In fact, in Zach Square, we found the remains of a sacrificial disposal area. It seems like with just thousands and thousands and thousands of tiny bones that we're not sure if they were bird bones or fish bones, but clearly they were depositing their sacrificial remains in this area, and they did a real careful job. And I think Zach found a coin in the middle of that layer, which was real important. And we can't date the coins right away because they're so corroded, but it will be an important piece for dating that whole deposit. And so we look forward to the results of that.
Wow. So what are the coins like? From this period, they're made out of stone, I assume.
No. They're made out of bronze, right?
Most of them bronze, yeah.
So you find it, like I found my coin, it was about the size of like a half dollar, maybe a little bigger, and it was very blue, like it looked like, I don't know, some kind of big blue stone, I guess you could say. And you don't really know unless like you know like what an eroded coin would look like. But at first I was like, this looks very important. So,
And it was.
It was pretty cool to find something like that. I actually found another coin sifting. So it's fun finding coins. It's more exciting than pottery.
I should think. Well, part of the thing with pottery is, after a while, aren't you just finding the same thing over and over again? Aren't you just finding little pieces of the same pottery, basically?
Oftentimes, it depends, again, where exactly you're digging. And as you go down locus by locus, you'll find different kinds of pottery, whether it be Roman-era pottery, which is very different from Byzantine pottery, which is more painted and still has color on it, where Roman pottery is more delicate and in different color. So there are some differences. But this year we did find some major pieces of pottery that were still intact for the most part. Zach's group found a gigantic amphora, which held, this is not my field.
So oil or wine.
Okay, that's what I was going to go with. And my group found some smaller pots, and they found some perfume vessels that were intact. So sometimes you do get lucky and find some big pieces.
I bet that's tremendously exciting after shards and shards and shards to find something that has survived after all these years.
Yeah, I think, and we were fortunate in terms of some of the finds. I think one of the most frustrating things for the students is we don't have our first pottery reading probably until a week into the dig. So they've been working and collecting all this pottery every day. And then the ceramicist comes from Jerusalem and sits down with all their finds and throws 95% of them away and says, this is junk. And she reads the remaining 5% and says, this is interesting. And so that's always a little bit disconcerting, I think, when it first happens.
Yeah.
So why would some of it be junk? I'm not sure I understand.
It's not distinctive enough to define a style
or
a date. her job is to say, this is a rim of a pot that we can date between X and X. And so if she body sherds and things like that that just are not indicative, I guess,
right.
is
just
the phrase.
Nondescript,
exactly.
Literally. Okay.
Exactly. Could be anything.
Right. Gotcha. Wow. Over the course of this dig, in what way did the experience kind of change, if it did? Or was it pretty much the same sort of work start to finish? I mean, obviously you were making some kind of progress. Did that progress end up altering what you were doing or how you were doing it at all?
Yeah. Like, when we first started, it seemed kind of like, you know, you're just moving dirt for the most part. And then you find pottery, and then you're like, ooh, this is pretty cool. And then after that, you know, you keep finding pottery, you're moving dirt, and then you find a lot of big pottery or a concentrated area of pottery, and then you have to slow down for a while, at least in my area. And then eventually we get down to bedrock, if you're lucky. And then after we're done with that, we move to a different area, like, or a different square, let's say, and start digging. And for us, we found a lot of really cool stuff right away when we started digging our new square. So, and this was towards the end of the season. So we're, like, freaking out because we're finding all this cool stuff, but the end of the season's coming, so we can't continue working on this stuff. So... I think it gets pretty exciting as you go along.
Like, yeah.
You don't really get wear down. You're like, oh, another day digging. It usually happens towards the end of the season. You start finding a lot of cool stuff and bigger stuff. For some weird reason, I don't know why that happens, but
it's to get you to come back. Yeah. That's the
what I'm trying to figure out here too. How much of this is kind of an individual quest versus communal? I mean, is it just as exciting for you if Amanda finds something, or is part of this that you as an individual doing all this sifting and digging and so on can find something?
I think it's a little harder to relate to other squares, but at the same time, because you're not working with that square, but if you see something that square pulled out, you're like, wow, you guys found that, you know? So you kind of, you're like, you try to figure it out and, like, think about how cool it would be for that square to find something like that. So in a way, I think it is very cool. I think it's a lot cooler for the directors because they oversee everything and they're able to participate in each and every one's square. So,
which means we also have to dig in everyone's square, which is...
How big is the square?
It varies. My square was actually part of 9 squares. Our area was much bigger than everybody else's.
Oh.
We were digging outside the temple and exposing the northern wall.
Mm-hmm.
And Zach's square was a different size because we were digging inside the temple, but between two walls. So that was that whole area. So it depended, but it is officially certain.
5 by 5 meters grid.
Meters. Yeah.
So everything is related to that grid. It's just that sometimes we make the decision that we want to do a probe that crosses several squares rather than staying within the 5 by 5 meter standard.
Now, until this group returns, basically nothing will happen with this place where you were digging.
Right.
Do you do something to leave it protected in some way? Protected from the elements, or don't you have to worry about that?
We did, actually, while the students were there, and whenever they had extra time for the last 3 weeks, they were filling sandbags, which is another fun job. And we, after they
you
left...
You might want to get a second opinion about that.
After we, well, they, compared to what we did with the sandbags, I don't know. The process, we actually had to build a wall against this frescoed wall that Zach's group found.
Hmm.
And that took a long time and a lot of effort because sandbags don't necessarily just stand up by themselves. You really have to build a solid base and build up.
Hmm.
So we did that to protect that wall. We had a plaster restore or come up and preserve a couple of other areas that we found that we wanted to make sure were protected from the elements. The problem is these things have been protected because they've been covered by dirt and stones for probably 1500 to 1900 years. Mm. And so we've exposed them and the elements can get at them. So we need to go back then and try to protect as best we can. We also, after the students left, built shelters and put a lot of the frescoed blocks in these covered, basically they're wooden crates with a sheet metal roof that is a way of trying to at least give them some cover from the shade, from the sun and from rain during the off season. So we try to do that. We have a fence around the site that's more or less adequate, and we have a gate that we can lock that prevents vehicles from getting up there, mm-hmm. which in the past people have actually bashed down the gate, but we hope that it will stay this year intact.
I know that since your return, one thing that's probably been a little disturbing and disconcerting is to see the conflict that has broken out between Israel and Lebanon. And Dan, you were telling me that even this area or sort of the route along which you traveled has been part of this.
Sure.
It's been a site of some of this fighting. Tell us more.
We were the site is actually located about between 5 and 10 miles east of Kiryat Shemona. And Kiryat Shemona is on the news every day. Yeah. A lot of the reporters are based in Kiryat Shemona, although I'm not sure where they're staying. There's not a lot of accommodations nearby. But they're reporting from Kiryat Shemona, and they've shown pictures of buildings that have been hit. They've shown pictures of the road that we drove on every day with shell craters in it. It's a little bit troubling. We have been in touch with the people at the kibbutz where we stayed, at Farsold. And they have had shells land near the kibbutz or on the kibbutz land, not in the kibbutz proper, apparently, and haven't had any injuries to this point. We're grateful for that. We know also some friends at another kibbutz nearby, Kibbutz Amir, and they have had some shells land in their or near their factory on the kibbutz and also kill some livestock in their herd from Kibbutz Amir. So this is right in the middle of the area where we were digging. And we did have shelling one day when we were there in late May, and it was the kind of thing is if it had persisted, we would have gotten out right away, but it stopped after the one afternoon, and then didn't happen again during the time we were there.
Wow. Does this current situation imperil your next visit?
It's a little too early to tell. Of course, it raises questions.
Right. And that's a better way to put it. Mm-hmm.
It raises questions. We can't be as certain as we were 3 weeks ago that we were definitely going back next year. We'll have to wait and see what happens with the political situation. As you know, the Israelis have had this conflict with the Hezbollah in southern Lebanon before, and they've actually occupied southern Lebanon before. And so it goes in cycles, it seems like, and we'll just have to see how the cycle progresses before between now and when we have to make a decision about the next year's excavation.
This must be interesting for you to see these images on your TV screens, and I imagine they affect you in a way very differently from 3 years ago or 5 years ago or 10 years ago when you would have seen scenes like this and wouldn't have meant the same thing. What has the impact been for you?
It's fairly difficult. A lot of us from the trip have kind of flocked together, and so there's a website by one of the members from McAllister where he's posted information, and we a lot of us are keeping in contact fairly regularly, which is somewhat comforting because it's difficult for other people to understand. Like, you know, I was, you know, at the kibbutz and, you know, just a few weeks ago, and we really lived there, and it kind of became our surrogate community while we were gone because everyone at the kibbutz was so inviting and welcoming, and we really were part of their lives as much as they were part of ours. And it's fairly hard to comprehend that where we were just a few weeks ago and where we lived, where we slept and where we relaxed is, you know, now more abandoned and, you know, in danger. So it's something it's very hard to kind of understand and feel every day because you're like, oh, look, Kiryat Shemona was in the news. We were there, you know, several times every week.
We were there. We were in the middle of all this.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a scary situation on a lot of different mm-hmm. levels. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure you think about this archaeological site that you've left behind you and hope that it's not going to be the end up being kind of an accidental target of if there is such a thing.
Well, the site obviously takes second priority or lower to our friends, our human friends in the area, and it's a bit of a concern, and the region has obviously gone through lots of conflict over the years, and again, you get to the point where when everything was covered over by 3 meters of dirt, it was really hard to damage it. Now that we've exposed it,
I guess that's what I was thinking. Yeah, there's it in a sense is vulnerable in a way that it wasn't before, and I guess that's kind of an inescapable facet of archaeological work.
Exactly. As soon as you expose something, you have to take care of it. And obviously, in this case, we can't do much about the dangers, but we try to do what we can.
Yeah. Well, we'll be certainly following the situation with great interest. Your hope, though, is that you'll be taking another group next year.
Yes. That is our hope.
We'll hope that that works out for you. Dan Showalter is a professor of religion at Carthage College. Amanda Kidwell and Zach Myers, both about to begin their senior years at Carthage College, and we wish you well. And Jeremy had to go off to work at Carthage, so he had to sneak out a few minutes ago. He'll be returning at some point to St. Olaf College as a political science major. I really appreciate all three of you joining us today for what I think has been a very, very interesting conversation, and we wish all of you the very, very best.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Gregory Berg.